Welcome to the Voices Podcast, where we are elevating voices who are reimagining faith.
God is not so big that you'll never, ever get to know him, which is kind of the Christian response. Like, oh, geez, I'm never gonna understand. The Jewish response is, no. God is big, huge, massive, enormous, so that you'll be able to learn something new about this God every day for the rest of your life. And that the journey of discovery is ultimately what faith is, not the ownership of your doctrines.
Hey everyone, I'm Kyle.
And I'm Gary.
And on this episode of the Voices Podcast, oh my gosh, I'm so excited because we got Kevin Nooner on the podcast.
And this guy, oh my word, he is going to break your brain multiple times. So we know Kevin because we started a church in a very close location next to him. So we met him just organically through church planning stuff and just have this affinity for this guy. So he is somebody who has really helped in our journey, helping us work through some of the different questions we're having regarding faith and trying to reimagine something that we felt was, I don't know a great word for it, but maybe felt more faithful to who we were and the questions we were asking and the journey that we were on. So he's been so helpful in the journey. He's like Bible scholar, businessman, literally does everything, right?
Yep. I mean, absolutely everything. A creator does all this stuff. So specifically in this episode, if you're having questions about, is the Old Testament relevant? How do I read the Bible? All that kind of stuff that I think that Gary, you and I are still going through.
Yeah.
Kevin, oh my gosh, opens so much of that up, makes it so clear, specifically going to how going to Israel can actually help open up a lot of this stuff and make these stories a little more meaningful.
Yeah. So we're excited for you to hear from Kevin, our friend, and we'll probably have him on more episodes in the future. So here's Kevin.
All right, everyone. Well, today on the Voices Podcast, we have our friend Kevin Nooner with us. How's it going, Kevin?
Good. Nice to see you guys.
Thanks. Thanks for coming on.
It's my pleasure.
Go ahead and tell our listeners a little bit about yourself because we actually met you because you are a pastor in the same area where we planted our church.
Yeah.
Way back when.
What would you like to know? My wife and I planted Spark about 5 years ago now, and I do that full time. I create these little videos on the side. I just got my MBA from the University of St. Mary. I do some leadership and organizational health consulting for churches and organizations and some international NGOs. And then I sit in the kitchen and do podcasts.
So a little bit of everything essentially.
So is there anything that you're not good at?
Making money. First,
okay. Okay. Yeah. I guess that would happen with creative
I'm
work.
I'm still
right?
on a pastor salary. So, you know.
Nice. Well, so then one of the reasons we want to have you on is because you do these, I had called them pilgrimages initially. And I learned just now that there's a different name for those.
Yeah.
In-depth study tours.
Yeah. So probably about 10, 12 years ago, Danielle and I got on this tour to Israel, and it was a kind of a last minute effort. And it was with a gentleman by the name of Ray Vanderlaan. I don't know if you've know who he is, but he has produced these videos with Focus on the Family and Zondervan, and it's been very well received. Anyway, he did a pastor's tour, and somehow we got in. And it was one of those moments where my wife, who I call Sparky because she gets us going on things, she signed us up and then told me about it later.
Perfect.
And I'm the CFO of the family, and I'm like, do you realize how we will no longer have a savings account after what you just did? And so, but throughout my faith journey, I suppose, going to Israel was always something I wanted to do. I've always been curious, wanted to learn, wanted to study, et cetera. And the stating that I'm the CFO of the family is really important for what I'm about to share next. We get on the plane, head on over, we get off the plane. We're exhausted. Of course, it's like 22 hours worth of travel.
Gosh, that's so far.
And every time you go, it's about 22 hours of travel. And we get on the bus and the first place we stop is Carmel, Mount Carmel. And we hear the story of Elijah and the Baal prophets. And we had just liquidated our savings essentially to go. And I turned to Danielle after site one of day one. And I said to her, if we turned back and went home right now, the entire trip would have been worth it.
Wow. And
the reason is because there are, oh my goodness, so many different reasons. But one of them is the images or the views that one has of reading the Bible are contextualized by your environment, by the thing that you grew up in, by the church that you grew up in, et cetera. And when you land in Israel and you think about history and geography and culture and language and socioeconomic, political context, when you start doing all that, everything shifts, your brain shifts, and what many people call a paradigm shift, and you start thinking about things completely different. So for example, Carmel is right on the edge of the Jezreel Valley, which is the location of a mountain or a hill called Megiddo. And Megiddo was the central location, massive trade. It was a military outpost. And if you want control of the land in that location, you have to hold this city, Megiddo. Mm-hmm. Well, in Hebrew, you to say mountain or to say hill, you have to say har. And then the city's name is Megiddo, which probably comes from a root word, which means to speak or to tell. But anyway, har, Megiddo, translates its way into English as Armageddon. And so the Battle of Armageddon in Revelation that you read about is actually referring to a geographical location called Har Megiddo in the Valley of Jezreel, the Jezreel Valley, where all of these biblical stories take place. And it's not so much what we have imagined, fire and brimstone, apocalyptic moon turning blood and all these kinds of imaginative things. It's really about control of the world. It's really about who's going to hold power and where the great battles are going to be fought on the, you know, the great trade route of Israel. Fascinatingly enough, Israel actually has an Air Force base right there located in the Jezreel Valley near Har Megiddo or near Armageddon. So that's a lot of fun. So we were there and got to see some, you know, I know nothing about military language. So I don't know, F-35s flying overhead while, you know, we were standing there talking about not only the Baal prophets and Elijah, but also about the end of the world, but what that means contextually and historically. So
were you doing some of this study about context, economics, politics of the time of when the Bible was written? Were you already doing that, or was this an intro when you took this trip over there?
Yeah, I'm going to say yes, just simply because if you are a student of the Bible, you always are, you know, reading your study notes or you read some authors that bring in particular things. But the difference is it doesn't click. The brain was, for many of us, incapable of really understanding. You know, it's kind of like the biblical, I have eyes but do not see, I have ears but do not hear. So you could hear somebody talk about a particular location or a language thing, but until you've actually immersed your soul into it and start to get to feel what these people would have felt or to understand what they would have understood, then it's really hard for us to understand the original context. And so it does take work. And part of the shift is an experience, is to get on the ground, to walk it, and to start immersing yourself in a different way of thinking. Even the language itself, for example, Elijah, we all say Elijah. Well, the original, one of the first names of God is Elohim, and the divine name of God that God gives to Moses in Exodus 3 is Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, or what we often say Yahweh, but we don't really know how it's pronounced. So El-Li-Yah is, in his name, is the meaning, our God is Yahweh. And so when he's talking about the Baal prophets, you know, call upon your God, call upon your God, and they yell back, Elijah, you know, they're actually declaring our God is Yahweh. You know, that's all woven into the context of the story. And Baal in Hebrew means Lord. And so you've got all of these beautiful poetic nuances that you just don't see when you read the English. And when you're not there. So for example, Elijah goes up on the mountain, he slaughters 400 cattle, he goes down the mountain, slaughters the prophets, he goes up on the mountain, sorry, I misquoted, he slaughters a bull, slaughters the 400 prophets of Baal down in the Kidron Valley, Sorry, not the Kidron Valley. I'm getting my names mixed up, but down the
you could have just kept going, and I'd be like, yeah, okay, totally.
the spring down there comes back up the mountain, goes back down the mountain, and then he races the chariot all the way to the city. And you can read that, but we actually climbed it. It is a climb. It's like 2,200 feet. So you're talking about somebody who has really physically emphasized commitment, discipleship, passion. He's making a mockery of the Baal prophets. You know, maybe he's thinking, which is kind of a euphemism for maybe he's sitting on the toilet, you know, where is your God? Where is your God? And all of that stuff. So Elijah becomes this kind of preeminent symbol of what does it mean to have passion, or in Hebrew, you'd say chutzpah, to have that for being dedicated and committed to God, to Yahweh. So you learn all that while you're there. And part of it is climbing up the mountain, climbing down the mountain, and getting that particular feel. And the reason why that's important is because later on in Matthew chapter 16, Jesus says, so who do men say that I am? And the disciples say, well, some say that you're Elijah, the prophet. And so it kind of gives you an insight into why these disciples would say that. I mean, Elijah was kind of this preeminent image and figure in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew scriptures, for somebody who is deeply, passionately, almost wildly eccentric in commitment to God. And then the disciples say, well, some people say you're Elijah, come back. So it kind of gives you an insight into who this Jesus character is. You know, not the white robe, blue Miss America sash floating 3 feet above the ground with the gold halo above your head kind of Jesus, you know, but really on the ground, earthy, kind of in your face, maybe a little bit sarcastic, but definitely a little pushy. And you see that especially in other passages, like in the end of Matthew, where he's, my favorite passage, he's telling you Pharisees, you hypocrites of the law, you hypocrites, you go out into the world and you make converts and you make them twice the sons of hell that you are.
So encouraging.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Try saying that to your pastor. Just give that a try and see what happens.
So, yeah, see if you are still attending that church the next week or not.
Yeah.
No. So anyway, yeah.
So you, okay, you took this trip out there, and now you want to keep taking more people. So tell us more about the journey that you were on when you went out there. What was it that really stuck out that made you go, we got to get more people out here?
Well, I have to give credit to my wife. She's really the leader, and she's the tour leader. She's been developing the trips. She a couple years later spent 3 months living in Israel, went to Jerusalem University College, studied with some brilliant professors. So she's the one who's really developed it. And over time, the two of us have been leading these tours for the last 10 years or so. And the reason why we go is because people who have been reading these stories their entire lives, when they land in Israel and you start teaching history, context, culture, language, all of that stuff, you start to see maybe perhaps like Paul, scales fall from their eyes. And all these creative, imaginative ways that we think about these texts begin to take on a completely different shape and a completely different way and even modes of thinking. The example that's coming to mind right now, you know that passage in Matthew 13, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, move from here to there and it will be done for you. Mm-hmm. So when I first read that passage as an early Christian, I lived in Napa and I was driving by Mount St. Helens and I was like, okay, I have faith. I really want to express that I have deep faith, which means that I am really committed to God in my heart and in my soul and my spirit. And I'm going to pray that this mountain literally moves. And that will be a sign that I, driving in my crappy beat up car down the 29 right now, really am a faithful.
Did it work?
No, fascinatingly enough. And hence my first faith crisis right there. So that was kind of the way that I thought about it, because you're taught to that this is the Bible, this is God's word. The Bible says it, I believe it, and that settles it. And there's really no more thinking beyond that. So what we do is we go to Israel and we land, and there's this little lookout off of Hebron Road, and you stand there and you look about 6 miles away, there's a mountain in the Judean desert that is clearly poking up out of the sky. And Josephus and other historians talk about its development and its construction. Anyway, this mountain is called the Herodion. The Herodion is a mountain or a hill, a palace out in the middle of the Judean desert that Herod actually cut off another mountain and moved that dirt to that mountain to build his palace so that it would be the highest in the land. And you can see it very clearly from that cliff. If you're on the Mount of Olives in Israel, you can see it very clearly on a nice clear day, sticking right up into the skyline. In other words, Herod literally moved a mountain in order to build his palace there. And it's just kind of mind-blowing to think about that. So the reason why we stop at that cliff off of Hebron Road is because also right there is growing a mustard seed plant, a mustard plant. And so we take the little flowers off and we put the little mustard seeds in the hand, and they are really, really tiny seeds. But the mustard plant also grows into this, it's kind of like a weed. It grows all over the place and takes over wherever it's growing. And then we read that passage. If you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will be done to you. And my interpretation, and I admit it's an interpretation, is that Jesus is making some sort of reference to this mountain that Herod moved. And what Herod the Great did in his particular time is being used as a metaphor or as an example or as a lesson for the disciples that you will be able to move mountains in this way, whether that be political or social. You'll be able to change the landscape. You'll be able to influence people, which ultimately they did, because most of the Christians, anyway, that we take over there have heard of Peter, Andrew, James, John, etc., Jesus, Paul, but they didn't know about the Herodian. So in other words, they had this small faith and they were able to move, I don't know, millions and millions and millions of mountains, and Herod moved that mountain. There, another passage, which is one of my favorites, is that the road is narrow and the gate is small and few enter into it, and that leads to life, and wide is the road and broad is the gate that leads to destruction. Well, we'll take you to a place there. I'm giving away all my secrets.
No, now nobody's going to want to. I don't know. I want to go even more now that I'm here.
I know, seriously. So I'll take you to a place called Beit Shan. It's also known as Scythopolis. And it's the beginning of the place of the discussion for what Alexander the Great did, in essentially starting in 333, heading all the way into Israel, where he set up shop. And when you read, when you walk the roads between the Israelite, the kind of the small little towns that Jesus came from, Bethsaida and Chorazin and Capernaum and and Gamlin, all these places, they're very narrow roads. They're like 1-2 person width, and they're on dirt roads. But when Alexander the Great comes through and sets up shop, and then Rome takes over and starts setting up their civilization and their cities, these roads are huge. I mean, like where we are, we have the 101 and the 280, whoever's listening to this. Picture your highways. They're long, they're huge, they're broad. But those are the roads that lead to the gymnasium where boys and girls studied naked together, philosophy. There's the arena where there's bloodshed for entertainment. There's the theater where there's all sorts of immorality that happens. You know, there's a passage in the Talmud that says, cursed is the man whose shadow darkens the door of a theater. So these are places of Hellenistic philosophy and ideas, and those are the roads that lead there. So when he's talking about wide and narrow roads, my interpretation is he's not talking about how many people are actually going to be in heaven and hell at the end of time, which is the way I kind of grew up thinking about it. But he's talking about a way of living and what that way of living actually gets you. Because those narrow roads, they take you to the synagogue and to the community and to the people of God who sacrifice their lives for one another. The wide roads take you to the gymnasium and the arena and the hippodrome and the theater and all these places of Hellenistic philosophy. And there's some amazingly beautiful literature written on the conflict between Hellenism and Israelite theology and ideas and worldviews. And it's you cannot read the New Testament, in my opinion, without understanding Alexander the Great. It's, at least in my humble opinion, it's, you miss so much, because it's woven all throughout.
Wow.
So I'll share this one for you, Gary.
Okay.
Just because I think you'll appreciate this, and I hope it doesn't get your podcast labeled with explicit.
That's going to happen inevitably.
It's coming. Yeah.
So what happens to Jewish boys when they're born on the eighth day?
They get a little bit cut off the top.
So this comes nice. So they have this very minor or major, depending upon how old you are, operation on the eighth day, and that comes from the covenant of Abraham from Genesis 17. So every Jewish boy in that time period would be circumcised. Now, the Greeks had a different idea. They thought that the human body in its form was beautiful and perfect exactly the way it was. And so for them, the idea of circumcision would have seemed like mutilation or some sort of desecration of this beautiful body. In fact, that's why there's so many naked statues of Greeks all over the place, because that was the form of beauty.
Oh.
Whereas the form of beauty and highest value for an Israelite or somebody from the Abrahamic covenant is much more about your devotion and dedication to Yahweh than it is about your body. It's about covenant. So you have these two conflicting worldviews. What happens when Alexander the Great moves in? You have theater where people are acting out brilliant plays and dramas. You have the gymnasium where boys and girls are studying naked together and competing in physical games and the Olympics and all that kind of stuff. I have a couple pictures and show this sometimes when I teach this of varieties of feats of strength. There's this stone that looks like it just weighs like 500 pounds. And on it, inscribed in Greek, is, if I get this right, Philos, son of Biblon, lifted this stone over his head with one hand. And it's just this huge, massive thing. You're like, now if you're a Jewish boy and that moves into town, do you want to go see that? You're like, I want to go see that. Somebody's throwing a javelin. Somebody's doing a long jump. Somebody's, you know, wrestling, you know, and all that stuff. But it's one step further. Not only do you want to see it, you want to participate in it. You want to do those things. You know, you are essentially seduced into that way of living. So we have good evidence in Jewish writings, in pagan writings, and in your Bible of teenage boys going through a process of reverse circumcision called epispasm. Uh-oh. So that they could participate in these games. That's in your Bible, actually, in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, because Paul mentions that you shouldn't have to become anything different in order to be a follower of Christ. And he mentions, are you uncircumcised? You should not get circumcised. If you're circumcised, you should not get uncircumcised. He's actually referencing this event.
Okay.
And the reason why that's there is because all these Jewish boys are going, I shouldn't say all, there's a contingent of Jewish boys, you know, in their teens going through a process of epispasm so that they can participate in these games. And you don't understand why Paul would write that in 1 Corinthians or why there's such seduction into this way of life unless you understand what Alexander the Great did and how he set up shop to seduce people into this new way of living, which, by the way, we've inherited. All of us have inherited Hellenism in some particular form or manner.
See, this is why we wanted to have Kevin on the show. See, the agenda was like, okay, he does these tours to the Holy Land and everything, but we just kind of knew if we get him on this show, who knows where it's going to go, but it's going to be good.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. And so you learned, or you were exposed to a lot of this, if not all of it, from actually going to Israel?
So yes and no. What I would say, and this is what we try to share with people, is that all of this, all of what we're talking about, is actually quite available to everybody else. I've likened this journey of mine to the Chronicles of Narnia, in that there's this wardrobe in your house that has been there this entire time, and you've never really gone into it. But once you open the door and you get past the fur coats, you find that this world exists that has been there this entire time that nobody ever talked to you about. So people have been writing about this stuff and publishing on the historical and cultural context and the linguistic context of the Bible for years and years and years. The problem is that I don't want to qualify it too much, but it seems like there's very few of us that actually care about that kind of context. And all it takes is somebody being curious. All it takes is somebody saying, I want to know more. All it takes is somebody willing to ask a question and to have enough kind of chutzpah is the only kind of word that I can think of, but a little bit of pushiness to say, but wait, I really want to know, why is that in there? Why would they write that? What is that referring to? What was going on during that time? Who was the emperor? What is Hellenism? Why is Alexander the Great important? What does that name mean? Every name in the Bible has a name, has a significance in it, and it points out something. Why are there midwives at the beginning of Exodus? Why is there blood on the lintels? Why is there passing through the Red Sea, which is actually not the Red Sea, it's called the Reed Sea. And the reason why that's important is because Moses is placed in the reeds and Pharaoh is acting like a reed and then they pass through a Reed Sea. So there's that mistake that needs to be corrected.
My mind just exploded.
My brain hurts.
So all it takes is somebody willing to ask those questions and to push in asking those questions, and you will discover an entire world that will completely upend and change your paradigm and how you read the Bible. Going to Israel is kind of like the getting it all in one scoop because it, number one, at least for our tours, it is a 2-week full immersion experience in all of this. Mm-hmm. But you can get much of this without going, but if you do go, you will have an experience like no other in its full immersion and in a community conversing, talking, discussing about these things for 14 days straight. And then that will give you the tools to continue that journey even once you get home.
Gosh, that sounds amazing.
Yeah. Okay. So I have to, we might go a little sideways in this conversation real quick, but I got to ask this question. So it sounds like at some point in your journey, you were faced with what I inherited in my Christian tradition, asking questions like, hold on a second, how in the world did all this get missed? So, and I think right now the buzzwords are deconstruction, reconstruction, all that. So you had to be going through this deconstruction process. And I think what I've seen is that can be something that takes somebody to a place of just complete bitterness anger at their church, at their leaders, at their tradition. So did you ever go through that, or was this kind of, was it just like an awakening and curiosity kept propelling you forward? Or did you ever say, well, scrap, like, how could I keep doing this thing if nobody's telling me the real truth that's going on here?
That's a really good question. I think the first word that comes to mind when you're asking me that question is really the word discovery. Somewhere along the line, in my study through, I don't even know where you picked this up. You learn, let's say step one, Jesus was Jewish. Okay. Let's just start there. Jesus was not a Christian and he didn't go to church. Now that
offended at least 7 people, I know, 7 of our 10 people that listened. Yeah.
that may seem somewhat obvious, but there are tours to this day that show up and say, take me to the church that Jesus went to. So that's still kind of exists. So if you start with Jesus wasn't a Christian, he was a Jew, and the movement that he started became Christianity, no doubt, later on in Acts, then that asks, that opens up a variety of questions of, well, what did it mean to be Jewish in the first century, and why is that important? I would encourage anybody to consider N.T. Wright's book, The Challenge of Jesus, which is kind of one of the first books that I wrote. Who is, he's a preeminent New Testament scholar. And in that book, he talks about if the word in John chapter 1 became flesh, then we must accept that this flesh was first century Jewish flesh and entails and encompasses all that that flesh has to teach us. And just that one statement alone can lead you to a lifelong journey of discovery. Well, one of the things that I discovered along the way, people like Abraham Joshua Heschel, who's been very influential, at least in my spiritual and intellectual journey, talks about how I did not really ask for answers, but I asked for wonder and amazement and mystery and discovery.
Yeah.
And Christianity, at least the way that I was brought up under, and I'm sure many, the people that are probably listening to this, grew up under a Christianity that was about doctrine, about absolutism. I listened to a radio host growing up that said, we know that we know that we know, kind of this certitude. Mm-hmm. And if Jesus was a first century Jew who embraced mystery and discovery, One of the quotes, I can't remember who it's from right now, you know, Christianity has this idea that you have to know God fully. In fact, one of the popular books is how to know what you know, or knowing what you believe, or knowing why you believe, knowing what and knowing why you believe. So it's like, okay, now I know this. But then the discovery stops. I know it. And in a Jewish perspective, again, I can't remember who exactly said this, but God is not so big so that you'll never, ever get to know him, which is kind of the Christian response. Like, oh, geez, I'm never gonna understand. The Jewish response is, no. God is big, huge, massive, enormous, so that you'll be able to learn something new about this God every day for the rest of your life. And that the journey of discovery is ultimately what faith is, not the ownership of your doctrines or the certitude or the solidification or the calcification of what it is that you believe. And so just that one, like if you can embrace that and start to feel as if this life is, I get to learn something new every single day for the rest of my life. That in and of itself is what this faith journey is about. So back to your question about deconstruction. Absolutely, I would say that there's been some deconstruction, but at least in the way that I've heard that word used, there's been kind of a sense of disappointment and almost ticked offness as to the people that taught you X or taught you Y. It's like, I can't believe you taught me this and it's so wrong. So it's almost like some sort of generational angst. And I totally understand, and I don't want to take anything away from that. For me personally, I haven't had so much angst as I have had just the joy of discovering something new. And I've been it's been very easy for me to let go of theologies just simply because I'm like, well, if that's not true, that's not true. Let's go discover what is true. And the more and more I've done that, the more and more I've discovered how much you don't know, discovered how much more there is to know, discovered how mysterious and wild and crazy this faith journey is, and there's no more fear in it. And I think part of the way that people have talked about deconstruction and the angst that has come with it, you know, is really grounded in a lot of fear-based mentality and ideology that has caused people to say, well, if this isn't true, then you're in danger of X. And I guess I have really embraced the First John passage, perfect love casts out all fear. And if you're going to embrace that love, the love of the Father that's found in the Akedah, which is the binding of Isaac by Abraham, and which, by the way, is the very first occurrence of the word love in the Hebrew Scriptures, is a father sacrificing his son. And the first occurrence of the word love in the New Testament, or in the Gospel of John, excuse me, is John 3:16, a father sacrificing his son. It all has resonance back to the Abraham-Isaac story. When you start embracing that kind of love,
I'm shaking my head right now in disbelief because this is so amazing.
You know, you start realizing that there's very, very little, if anything, to fear. This journey's amazing, and the more and more, and this book's amazing. I used to think this book was true, and then I tried to convince other people that it was true. Truth is not something you have to convince people of if you just simply show its brilliance, and the way it describes humanity, the narratives that it speaks, and how it kind of illuminates kind of the anthropological and sociological views of what these people were going through and how that influences our thinking today. It's really just brilliant. If you want to talk about any issue that we were dealing with today, they dealt with it then. And by diving into those scriptures and diving into how they dealt with it, you get really deep insights into how amazingly thoughtful, insightful, progressive in many, many places these people were, even though most of us can't get past some of the archaic events. But there's ways to do that. So it's, I don't know. Did I answer your question?
Sure.
That's
okay. Okay. So I've got one last question, and this could lead into 37 more questions, but
okay.
We may just have to cut them off at some point because the human brain can only handle so much.
That means we can have him back. So that's fine.
Yeah, true. So here's my question. You've okay, you've done these tours in the Holy Land. You've done lots and lots of study. So the simple question is, what is the Bible?
Good simple way to end this.
We actually might need another 3 or 4 episodes based on where this goes, but I'm just very curious to hear Kevin's answer on this one.
Oh my goodness. You gave me zero prompting for this question.
Yeah, sorry about that.
We'll cue the outro music right now.
Yeah.
Well, you took me on a path where you're talking about all this stuff. And so, okay, here, let me frame it a little bit. I think one of the things that happens, again, talking about deconstruction and reconstruction, is Christians can deconstruct so much that they no longer know how to approach Scripture in a meaningful way that gives life to them. So I can say that is my own journey of it's asking questions or saying, I don't even know how to read this thing anymore because I was learned to do it as proposition. So I read it to get something out of it or to change something about me so I can please God. So there's got to be another way to approach this thing. So that's kind of where I'm going.
Yeah, the Bible's kind of like a tool for you.
Yeah.
A tool for your spiritual journey.
Mm-hmm.
Or it can be like a magic eight ball. Where you shake it and say, okay, give me my spiritual inspiration for the day. I used this analogy with some kids when I did a talk and they had no idea what it is. Maybe you will know. Some people use the Bible as the yellow pages. Oh, man, am I old.
Yeah.
So anyway, but the idea that you use it as a directory of things that if you need the seven highly habits of joyful people or something like that. You can find it in the Proverbs or something like that, right? So the Bible is seen by that. Yeah. Okay, I think I understand your question a little bit more. The Bible has been used. Well, I think we should start here. A lot of people don't like those different views of the Bible. And part of the deconstruction that many people are going through is that you know, well, it's not that anymore. It's kind of exactly what you described. But I usually try to take a little bit of a philosophical or anthropological view on things. Why or how did the Bible become such this wildly diverse thing that has deep meaning for people in a lot of different ways? There's something really pretty spectacular about that reality. In fact, the Bible Museum, which is opening up in Washington, D.C. this year, is the only museum dedicated to a book in the world. So
wow.
I would say that there's lots to discuss around the theology of the Bible or bibliology or the philosophy or its transcription or its development. But for anybody who is like, well, I just can't believe any of this anymore, or I just don't know how to read it anymore, or any of those kind of skeptical views, I guess I would just encourage the idea that this really is the only book in the world with its longevity and its impact. Now, I'm cautious enough to say that that may not be true into the future. I'm not a prognosticator in that sense. But if you go all the way back to the beginnings of the writing of the Bible and the text, why did this text survive in the cultural place that it did rather than other texts? Now, we can make some arguments about some more recent texts like the Quran or the Book of Mormon or the Bhagavad Gita or others. But the Bible has this longevity worldwide that I think is second to none. So we just start there. And then as with inquiry, you just start asking the question, why, how, and then what was it and how did it develop? More specifically to your question, what is the Bible? The reason why that question is so difficult to answer is because the question itself can be responded to dependent upon what presuppositions you have behind that question. Are you asking, well, what is the Bible to a Christian? Or what is the Bible anthropologically? Or what is the Bible technically? There's lots of different ways of going about it. And of course, there's lots of authors that have written extensively about starting with, well, the Bible is a collection. It's a library of the history of the people. It's actually the record, not of what God said, but of what people thought God said, which is some of the recent work that has been done, some of these changes and these developments. So I guess I don't really know how to answer the question definitively.
So then,
because let me so much.
Yeah, because I like the way you put it there. So what is the Bible to the Christian?
Well, that all depends on the Christian. There's some different denominations and different ideologies out there that say, for example, when I was growing up, you don't ever set anything on top of the Bible. So I, growing up in my household, and even though my mother's not religious at all anymore, if I set a National Geographic magazine on top of the Bible, that was sacrilege. How dare you set anything on top of it? Don't stand on it. You know, and so the Bible became essentially this magical artifact in my house, even though I had no idea what was written in it. So that's one particular view. And then later on, I grew up and I realized, wait a second, the Bible that I have is really just a translation published by a publisher who's making a lot of money off of this translation and put it in between two bonded leather covers to make it $70.
With gold edges.
Oh, and my name imprinted on mm-hmm. gold. And once I realized that, I'm like, oh, well, then forget it. I don't need to have the same reverence. And in fact, one of the illustrations that I've done years ago, which I don't do anymore because it is a little bit irreverent, but I got a Bible. It was a hardbound Bible. It wasn't one of those leather ones. And I drilled a hole through it. Half inch, 3/4 inch hole. And I drilled a hole through it and I wove a red thread through that hole. And my illustration was, wherever you open up the Bible, there you see the blood of Jesus. Right? Oh, yeah. So that was my illustration. But I remember some people being very, very upset that I drilled a hole through a Bible.
Yeah.
But my thinking had evolved, had changed. Well, that's not the Bible. That's a translation and it's a copy. By the way, it was a $2 copy given by the Gideons, right? So to the Christian, there's a lot of different ways of thinking about it. I suppose the way, maybe one of the questions you're asking me is, how do I see it? Or
yep,
what really is my view? I start with the question, I want to read a text or I want to be in relationship with people on their terms, not on my terms. So I want to come to the Bible not with presuppositions or biases that fundamentally skew my view of what it is, although everybody has some bias. But if I can recognize what those presuppositions are, what those biases are, hopefully I can mitigate the effects on my view and just let the Bible be whatever it is. Let it speak to me on its own terms rather than me telling it what it needs to be on my terms. That okay. is a huge, significant piece of a paradigm shift for approaching a text that is beautiful and wonderful and inspired and useful for teaching and guiding and rebuking. You know, that 2 Timothy 3:16 passage, which is wonderful. We shouldn't throw that away. I think some people that do the deconstruction say, well, it's none of that anymore. Well, no, it is, but just maybe not in the calcified, dogmatic, denominational way that you've seen it before. So just approach it on its own terms. Like when Job starts off with a bet between two, you know, supernatural beings, you know, let's start with the fact that it's a bet with two supernatural beings. This sounds like a crazy mythology. Now, it's not telling you that this is exactly ontologically what is true in space-time continuum. It's just saying one day, once upon a time. So let's approach it in that particular way. Same with the book of Jonah, all these stories. Mm-hmm. People quibble over whether it's literal or metaphorical. Well, it's both. It's both literary and metaphorical. And so just approach it according to its own terms. When Genesis starts off, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was formless and empty, and darkness was over the surface of the deep. You know, it's not telling you this is exactly what you need to believe about the scientific development of the universe. It starts with essentially once upon a time. So start with approaching the text in that particular way. Mm. Now, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people that are going to be very upset with that view. But depending upon what those objections are, we can go even further and deeper into the different approaches yeah. towards that.
Wow. That was great.
What a day.
We're definitely having Kevin back on this show. So
for sure.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, and, me too.
I guess thanks for listening and tune in next time.
Yeah. So Kevin, if people want to find out more about your work, what you're doing, you talked about videos at the beginning. You like threw it in there and your videos are excellent. So thanks. if you want to, like, where should people go to find you and all your creative work that you're doing?
I guess the simplest place is just go to kevinneuner.com, KevinNeuner.com. Somebody said to me, wow, you must be spiffy. You have a website. No, I have $300 and I can buy a URL. So let's just be honest about it. So, but I did that because of questions like these. It's just a simple place to go. And from there, you can find Spark Church. You can find Come and Learn to Walk Israel Tours, which the next one's in June. We'd love to have anybody come. It is open to the public. And then you can find the Via Media project that we're doing, which are creating some of these Bible videos for people to have and study and use in small groups and churches or whatever.
Sweet. We'll put all these links in our Patreon page. So if you forgot where all those are, go to patreon.com/thevoicespodcast and we'll have the link to all of Kevin's work there. Well, Kevin, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. It's fun.